Hello and a warm welcome to what is surely one of the highlights in the Bruin podcast diary, namely the visit of Straight Talking Terry Smith of Fun Smith. Now, along with his colleague Julian Robbins, we serve up another 25 minutes of the finest investment insight, this time focusing on company specifics as we take a closer look at names such as PayPal, Nestle and Philip Morris. But before any of this leading and exclusive commentary, please first listen to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast, and one that I think our listeners most eagerly anticipate as we're joined by Terry Smith and Julian Robbins of Fun Smith. Guys, thank you very much for sparing the time. We know you're very busy. How are you both?
Very well, thank you.
Very well, yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, as I said, it's very good to have you here with us. I think we want to have a conversation today. First of all, what we must do is congratulate you and thank you on behalf of our listeners and our clients for another good year for the fund. Certainly on a relative basis, most asset classes and certainly most funds in negative territory. So that you've eked out positive gains is a testament to you. But our listeners and our clients, you know, quite rightly aren't complacent. They want to know that there's more of the same to come. So I think on that basis, we do understand pretty well how you manage your assets. I think we might have more of a stock-based conversation today, looking ahead to the year. So some things that have gone well, some things that you've moved on from, and some things that haven't gone quite so well. So we'll start easy and gentle with you, and some of the stocks that have gone better. I guess Microsoft and PayPal have been some of the biggest contributors to attribution. But after that long and rambling introduction, it is now your turn. So why don't we start with PayPal and how that's shaping up and why that remains in the portfolio?
Thank you, Ben, for the comments about the performance, which we'll do whatever it takes. You can rely upon that. On PayPal, we came to this, of course, by buying eBay and keeping the PayPal segment after the split, which we don't regret at all. I think that was, at least so far, exactly the right thing to do. I'm sure most of your listeners will be familiar with it. It's a digital payments company. It's the leader in terms of online payments, and seems to be in quite a sweet spot in that regard, in that the liberation from eBay has accelerated its growth. And it keeps doing a phrase, we don't like some of these phrases always, but we can't think of better ones, what they call bending the curve, which is to say the growth rate, which is formidable in the high teens. And that is a very important component that we look for in terms of performance, is companies that can grow significantly. Doesn't show any signs of slackening at the moment, notwithstanding the fact that if you are growing at about 20% per annum, the size of your business is increasing significantly. Worth remarking upon. The other thing that is worth remarking upon, then perhaps I'll see if Jules would like to contribute to it, is that they had a part of their business that worried us. We were, it seemed to us, the only people on the planet who worried about this, because our background is that both of us were banking analysts in our broking careers. And PayPal had launched a thing called PayPal Credit. When you went on to pay with PayPal, it said, would you like to defer payment? Click on PayPal Credit. Amazingly, it offers me that when I buy one of my rugby league games to view for £2.50. I'm tempted to buy them on credit, just for the experience, as it were. And they were obviously building up a book of loans to people through that. And their mantra, if you like, was, this is a pretty safe form of lending because we've got a lot of data on our clients. Funnily enough, he and I both think we've seen this movie before and know how it ends. Because you know what? Banks have got a lot of data on you as well, and it doesn't stop them screwing it up. with monotonous regularity. And so we were worried about this. We're also worried about its effect on the balance sheet. It dominates the balance sheet and the sort of returns that you can get out of this. Banks don't make great returns on capital. I don't know if you've noticed, but they don't. They make abysmal returns on capital. And so we were sitting there thinking, well, we're the only people in the world worrying about this, except one other group of people remarkably seem to have worried about it and done something about it, the management. They spotted exactly the same issues and disposed of it.
Prompted by
themselves, I think. I don't think they were prompted by us. I mean, yeah, we have conversations with people, but I've no particular reason to believe that our interaction with them prompted this. I mean, they didn't sort of, there wasn't a sort of eureka moment where they said, you're absolutely right. Maybe it did, but I don't think so. So that we thought showed that we've got a management that's like-minded in terms of the way that it views its business. And that's very important to us because...
Is it an overhang on the balance sheet or is it really sort of minuscule? The lending.
I can't remember the actual size that it got to, Jules. Can you
remember? It got to about $6 or $7 billion. And I think, to Terry's point, I think one minute they were thinking that by providing their clients with some finance facilities, they were facilitating the main business. But I think simple maths told them that you know, very soon they were going to become a bank with a, you know, $20 or $30 billion balance sheet if they weren't careful, given the rate they were growing. So they've now got rid of most of the loan book. There's still a little bit left, and it'll probably actually start growing again to a certain degree. But they've now got a partner who's taking most of that on their books.
And it's difficult to be fair to them. It's difficult if you are got a business where you're generating these loans through offering this credit, and somebody comes along and you persuade them to buy the loan book, unless they're a complete idiot, which of course some of them are, it's very difficult to get them to take 100%.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't got anything in it, then presumably your desire to apply any kind of standard to what you're doing slips remarkably. So I think they've done the best that they sensibly can in terms of disposing of this risk. And we like that because, you know, when you choose to invest with us on behalf of your clients, you're subcontracting their capital to us to look after. You know, the reality of this process is we subcontract it to the management of companies. And therefore, seeing that they think what we regard as sensibly about things like that is a very important sign.
So well, obviously, execution is crucial to your investment. But I mean, are the dynamics in play that actually they can make a few mistakes because there's such a sort of a tailwind of the way, you know, of payment processing, you know, online, or do they really need to execute on point because of valuation?
I think that, well, I, to the first part of your question, I think the issue is that's both a good and a bad. A good in the sense that at the moment times are pretty benign, and so they can make mistakes. But at the same time, the problem at the moment is because there are so few bad debts around generally, it makes them think that they are good at it. Whereas I suspect it's really just a case of a rising tide lifting all ships.
Yeah, but they are, as I say, in this sweet spot with regard to payments at the moment, and they are the force outside China, at least, where everybody struggles to operate in online payments. And if you look at the growth of e-commerce, it's hard to see that other than, you know, as you know, we always look for a secular source of growth that drives that company. It's not just what they're doing, but what are they in? What's the thing that they sell that people will provide that people are going to want more of over time? It's hard to see that they haven't got a tailwind in terms of online payments, basically.
Okay, well, as you said, it was great to cover that company. It is an important part of the portfolio, but people will be relatively familiar with it. Perhaps some other names like IDEX has been a positive contributor to performance. Tell us a bit about the company and why it's in the portfolio.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one to alight upon because, as you say, people may not know very much about it. And I mean, there's a couple of things I'd like to say before we say about the company. One is it's its second appearance in our top five contributors.
Right.
It's exceeded in that by Microsoft, by the way, which has appeared four times as in our top five performers. As I say in my annual letter, so much for taking profits as a means of, as a strategy of investment. It may be that great old saying, which is attributed, I think, to one of the Rothschilds, which is nobody got poor by taking profits. Yeah, but I didn't get very rich either.
Yeah.
That would be our view. Anyway, that's one thing I would say generically about our experience. Like, the other thing I would say generically is we bought it, or our opportunity to buy it, because we'd followed it for a while, came when there was a glitch, for want of a better term. It's a Buffettism glitch. He looked for glitches. Famously, he bought his American Express holding when they had a huge glitch with a scandal in trading, believe it or not, edible oils, things like that, which they'd diversified into. And they were taken to the cleaners by organized crime in a scam. in that area, and he went and bought, that was his glitch that gave him his opportunity. So glitches in companies which really are good are sometimes the opportunity to buy them at a reasonable or cheap valuation. Of course, you have to persuade yourself that it's really a glitch and not an existential threat, because sometimes glitches are just the end of the world for them. So you have to decide which it is you've got in your hands. But anyway, IDEX, it's the world's leader. And when I say leader, I mean it's like the vast majority of the sector spending goes to them in veterinary diagnostic equipment. You take your pet down to the vets because it's not feeling very well. Unlike human beings, the vet can't have a conversation with them to see what's wrong. So diagnostics are a more important feature of veterinary medicine than they are of human medicine. And they will, if they've got the IDEX rapid assay or other facilities on premise, which a lot of them have, they'll take the blood sample or the urine sample and or samples of other things that we won't go on to in case people are eating while they're having business. and they'll go away and test it whilst you're in the waiting room. And 20 minutes later, bingo, you got your diagnosis. And that's actually quicker than most humans can get a diagnosis out of these things. And it's a very good business insofar as they supply this installed base of equipment to which they supply the consumables, the solvents, the software, the service and spares, etc., etc.
And again, are they sort of the dominant leading player in their sphere? Yeah,
Julian will remember the numbers better than me, but they spend, of all the R&D spent in that space, they spend 75 or 80% of it.
Yeah, for every $100 they spend 80% of it. The other interesting thing about this one, I think, is that we are generally very cynical of the word guidance. In fact, in our writings, we always put it in inverted commas because the ability of people to give guidance is often rather weak. But this is the first company that hasn't given us 25-year guidance, but has given us a 25-year picture of how they think things are going to develop. And the reason for that is that in the United States, where they're based, they have seen a 25-year development where people went from, at the start of the period, taking their pets to the vet twice, once to be spayed or neutered and once to die, to taking them to the vets in the same way that we as humans go to doctors, you know, for annual checkups, for blood tests, for physicals. They've seen that development in the States, and they see it starting here in Europe and now moving also to Asia and Latin America. So with a high degree of confidence, but certainly with a fair degree of confidence, they can say that they think they're pretty fair set for another quarter of a century, which is...
It's not hugely per faith for our listeners to get on tune with that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a short time horizon in our view. But we're prepared to live with it.
Right, okay, let's move on to some other names. Now, I don't want to overlap too much with your shareholder letter, which I'd encourage listeners to go out and read. It's always a very enjoyable, informative read. But Nestlé is such an interesting stock. You've moved on from it. I wonder, Terry, whether it's because we raised the issue of the death of brands with you the last time you were on this podcast, a narrative I'm sure you hadn't heard before. Is that the explanation, Terry?
No, it's not, Ben. Whilst we're addressing Nestlé, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you a little bit of notice, so as not to be totally unfair to you while your listeners are listening in on this. I'm going to ask you to name a brand that's died, since we hear so much. But anyway, let's talk about Nestlé. You can churn that over in your mind and bowl this brand that's died to us at the end. No, it's nothing to do with the death of brands, although actually we were never that keen on the brand set at Nestlé. The most obvious comparator is Unilever, and we knew from the outset when we owned both stocks that when we looked across from the brands from one to the other, we thought that the Unilever brand suite, whatever they want to know, was a more powerful one than Nestlé. I mean, to pick the most obvious area for it, if you say, well, you know, what's a brand area that Nestlé is got that you're not that mad keen on compared to Unilever? Confectionery. Confectionery is a generally challenged area for obvious reasons in terms of people's sort of change in their dietary outlook, and, you know, in terms of what they consume, and it's also fairly challenged in developing markets. I mean, confectionery, particularly chocolate confectionery, is not an obvious thing in very hot climates, for example. You know, so it's problematic.
Yeah.
Basically, so we never quite liked the Nestlé brand, so that wasn't really it. No, I mean, the decision really came down to this. As I said earlier, we allocate capital to companies, and the single most important thing we look for from the managements is how they deal with their capital allocation. Because these are wonderful companies. They're making like 28% return on capital employed. Well done. Single most important indicator of a good company. So every year, 28% of the capital is produced, you know, in more than 100%, quite often in cash return. What do they do with the money? They can give it back to us, pay a dividend, buy back some stock. They can invest in the business, or they can buy things. Those are their three choices. And usually they do some combination of those. And how well they do that is really the key determinant of how our portfolio will do. So we get very worried when people do certain things. In the case of Nestlé, we wrote it up actually in our previous annual letter, because each year, apart from just writing in the annual letter what we did and how we did, we try and pick a theme to tell people about how we operate. And last year, the theme was, that last year is in 2017, we wrote about activism. There'd been a lot of activism during the year. We'd had activists involved in ADP, our payroll company. We had activists involved in Nestle and so on. And so in IHG, we had an activist. So we sort of wrote up, how do we deal with activism? How do we interact with the company and the activists to decide which way to vote, if there is a vote, and so on. And Nestle had one of the US activists who got involved in the whole thing, and a man called Dan Loeb. And we didn't like their initial reaction, which is they were pushed to and published margin targets that we're going to go for. They were pushed to accelerate a share buyback program. So, you know, typically, not all activism, some of it's very good, but quite often this is the playbook. Buy a stake in company, shout at company in public, which we never think is quite the right way to at least start a discussion with the company, get them to take action, sell shares, go away, bank gains, leaving us as holders, sometimes with a business that's not as good as it was before, more highly leveraged, sometimes having to have to split the business, etc., etc. So we wrote that up, and we weren't keen on the fact that they were clearly reactive to the activists. They then went on to announce a deal which you may have seen, that they paid a bit over $7 billion to buy from Starbucks the Starbucks products which are sold in supermarkets, except the RTD drinks, the ready-made jars of chilled coffee and so on, which are sold. So not including that, which, by the way, is the good bit. So what they actually bought was the right to sell Starbucks bags of coffee. Now, I'm not very excited by that. That's the first thing to say. I mean, if you said, you know, what do I like about Starbucks? Not a stock we own, but it's a stock we follow. I would say, well, I think the retail offering is interesting and has done pretty well on the whole. And I would say the RTD offering in retail outlets, where the branded stuff has done pretty well. But the one bit that's not got any obvious advantage whatsoever is a Starbucks bag of coffee. Anyway, that's what they bought. They paid a very high price for it. And so we didn't like that. And the really killer for us was that in the small print, and I really do mean pretty much hidden, was the fact that they're going to pay a royalty to Starbucks on this over time as well. It's a great deal for Starbucks. But our view of royalties is we want to invest in businesses that receive royalties that other people generate using their capital, not the other way around. That's why we invest in franchisors, people like fast food and hotel franchisors, because they're using other people's capital and getting a royalty on it. So it had lots of alarm bells surrounding it.
Just on the brand's point, not quite answering your question yet, but the confectionery thing, mm-hmm. I mean, clearly management hasn't made the correct decision. Every decision has been correct in your eyes. But what about the idea that they are transitioning towards more of a sort of a well-being, nutritionally appropriate type offering? Are you seeing evidence of that? I mean, the confectionery thing's pretty well understood, do we think?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Well, it's got some businesses in there that are very good. I mean, this is not answering your question, but if we're having a debate about it, say, well, yeah, all right, sir, I get the challenge to confectionery. But as you've posed, well, there's this sort of attempt to move towards wellness, on which, by the way, they're on a path with many others. They're not exactly alone in there. That's the first thing I would say about it. It's a bit like you say, well, Terry, we know about the change in confectionery. We also know that everybody out there is heading down the wellness route. You know, I mean, if you listen to a PepsiCo presentation, you would be in no doubt whatsoever that that's not exactly an unoccupied space. So being able to distinguish yourself within that, or even just pull it off, is interesting. But they do have other good brands within there as well. So it's not an unalloyed problem. I mean, the Purina brands are in pet food, which, you know, going back to our IDEX comment, is one of the areas we really like. That's a very good brand area for them. So there are sort of pluses and minuses. But there's another factor I would lob into you, which is, you know that we have currently 27 companies, we never own more than 30.
Yeah.
And it's always about choices. We were sitting there looking at this and ranging it against another company that we hadn't owned before and thought, you know, seeing what they did with the Starbucks deal,
seeing that we don't think the brand suite is quite as strong as something we continue to own Unilever, and seeing this other one, which we're currently in the course of buying, we think that we'll be happier owning this other stock. It's because it's partly comes down to, it's not that Nestlé is bad, it's just relatively how do we feel about it compared to something else that we can own.
Yeah, it's portfolio management.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay, right. Well, let's move on to a couple of stocks, if we have time, about that haven't gone so well.
No, I've got to leave now.
Well, Facebook's in your shareholder letter, so maybe we will part that. Philip Morris on a quantitative basis, the biggest negative contributor to the fund last year. You know, absolutely. What is the background behind that, and why do you think the market may have got it wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the background to it is Philip Morris is the world's biggest tobacco company, outside China, where there's a state monopoly. It doesn't operate in the United States of America. When the company was split, it's basically the US operations of the old business there, which its problem in share price terms comes down to change in the tobacco industry. What we're seeing is the rise of reduced harm products, reduced risk products. So vaping, heat not burn products are coming up. And quite rightly, people are concerned when you get disruption, very, very sort of topical term.
We'll come back to that.
You'll come back to that, Ben. Whether or not the incumbents, how they will fare with the disruption. So we've seen, particularly in America, the rise of a vaping business called Juul, not named after our Juuls, spelled slightly differently.
I wish it had been.
Which is big in vaping. Has garnered a big share of the market in vaping. So people worry about disruption. Also, there's ranged against the growth in the reduced risk products are a lot of commentators and a lot of regulators who say the basic problem with these products is, they may be reduced harm, and they definitely are. I mean, there is no doubt about this. This is not a tobacco industry pitch. They are very significantly less harmful for you to consume. You're not smoking and taking in particulate into your lungs in the same way that you do when you light and actually ignite tobacco, basically. I mean, vaping doesn't have any tobacco, and the heat not burn is heating, so there isn't any tobacco particulate or anything like that coming up there. What the regulators and commentators who are against this don't like is that one of the groups of people who are very keen on all of this stuff are youth. The young people, teenagers, have taken to this like a duck to water. And their pitch, which is not wrong, is that the trouble with these products is they're very much trendier than smoking is. If you look at the Philip Morris product, which is the market-leading product in heat-not-burn called IQOS. If I were sitting with your viewers able to see us, and I put it on the table with your iPhone that I can see you've got over there, and your iPad, and you looked at the design of it, and I put the box down and said, okay, who do you think makes this product? You would say, I think Apple. It's very cool. Yeah. I mean, it's got that image, the way that it's portrayed. And so young people have taken to it, and the regulators and commentators don't like it. Say it will encourage them to consume nicotine, which is bad for them, and it may indeed be a stepping stone onto them doing actual smoking at some point. And whilst I think they're sort of right about that, the thing that I think is somewhere between silly and risible is the idea that you can legislate for teenagers not to do things that are bad for them. I mean, they're going to do stuff. This is just stuff that's less harmful than some of the other stuff that they might do, like smoking actual cigarettes. So I think that it's almost, there's a book by Barton Biggs, the famous strategist hedge fund manager, called Hedgehogging. And in it, he describes a broker. And if you've ever worked in broking, you will have had at least one colleague who matches this description. This was a broker that when Barton was confused about what to do about the stock market or a stock, he'd ring this broker because this guy was always wrong. And then he knew what to do. There are certain commentators out there, regulators, that if they're against something, you know it's right and it's going to work, basically. And I take great comfort. Anyway, going back to Philip Morris, that's the issue behind this. How are they going to fare in this world? They've got a range of products. They've got vaping products and they've got other products, but their leading product is this IQOS system, which is heats up the stick, and that's how you get inhale the vapor from it. It's the market leader and has cleaned up in every market where they've launched it. They're doing it market by market for a very simple reason. It's proved so popular, they're struggling to keep up with production. of the heat sticks that go in it. Secondly, they don't want to launch the device into a market and then not be able to supply the consumables that go in it, because they're frightened that somebody else will come along and generate those and put them into the device. And so, you know, when you look where they've launched it, like Japan, it's got 20% of the market from a standing start. That's remarkable.
It is. I mean, I don't want to talk about Facebook, but in your letter, you sort of talk about it being ubiquitous. I mean, the barriers to entry there seem pretty resilient, but in this next generation suite, you know, what is the confidence level that IQOS can't be displaced? And also, the combustible, also there's a lot of money that needs to be thrown at it, and the combustible side, as we all know, is sort of an ongoing sort of deteriorating story.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there are two things you said in there that I'll pick you up on. One is
it was all wrong, wasn't it, Terry?
No, it's not all wrong. just mostly, Ben. No, you said they're spending a lot of money. You're quite right. Philip Morris has spent $5 billion developing this.
Yeah.
Whilst that's a lot of money, I mean, it's not as if they don't get great returns. Yeah, cover it's a barrier to entry. No startup is going to spend $5 billion developing this, right? Most of the incumbents in the tobacco industry can't spend $5 billion on it.
Yeah, right? Imperial, I mean, certainly.
Imperial certainly can't do so, right? So I think that's actually good. I also think that their positioning in a couple of respects means it will be difficult to get past them, to have a disruptor get past them. That is obviously the worry, but one of them is, as I sort of waxed on a bit lyrical about, you've got to deal with regulators. And in any area like this, the best people to deal with regulators, funnily enough, are the incumbent tobacco companies. They've got decades and decades of experience of dealing with this. So the incumbent coming up with their new product is going to encounter that. Thirdly, it's sold somewhat differently. These things are not marketed through traditional CTNs and supermarkets and so on. They're sold through standalone stores or pop-up stores. You can go down to Regent Street and see one if you wish. And you can go to most big sporting events and you can see one. There's usually a pop-up at the British Grand Prix and places like that. They're ending up having to market a different type of thing directly. And that requires staff education, training, and a completely different skill set to the one that that the traditional tobacco industry has operated from. So I think it's difficult to get around them. But we might be wrong, you know? We are from time to time. That's why it's a portfolio and not. I mean, you mentioned Facebook and in the same conversation. It's today's the 23rd of January, so it would be a bit early to declare victory for the year. However, guess what our two best performing stocks by a considerable margin are so far in 2019?
Facebook and Philip Morris.
Very good guess.
Right, and then the other question that you posed to me earlier was about the death of brands. I guess the standard response, and it's just came to me, would be Schweppes in the face of Fever-Tree.
Yeah, okay. What are Schweppes' sales?
I don't know. Declining?
But no, I mean the number. I was looking for an actual number. Well, I'm going to tell you, Fever-Tree, which is a great success, is £200 million.
Okay.
Now, because you haven't got the Schweppes number, I'll tell you, you know, a drinks company that we do own, which is PepsiCo, not exactly Schweppes, I'll grant you, has got 22 brands with over $1 billion in sales. Fever-Tree is a great success, but at the moment, I don't think it's actually troubled the scorers in terms of destroying other brands. I think Schweppes is the victim at the moment from their success. I think you're right to alight upon it. But, you know, it's probably dented, particularly in the UK market, and we get a bit of hometown bias in our thinking about these things. Yeah. I'm not sure it's dented in very many other places because, you know, just, you know, frankly, Fever-Tree doesn't have the distribution to dent it in a lot of other places. And I also think, you know, either by skill or by judgment, I don't know which it is, I think that Fever-Tree's sort of attack on the mixer market, in which they've been very successful, and Schweppes, you know, has been one of the sort of victims, if you like, of that, is either lucky or clever, I don't know which one, because Schweppes is an unusually fragmented brand. Schweppes was part of Cadbury Schweppes, and when it basically spun out the drinks business, it sold the Schweppes business ended up as part of Dr. Pepper Snapple. But the history was so turgid of the whole thing that it's basically in the hands of different people in different places. So Schweppes is Dr. Pepper Snapple in, Jules will correct me, I think North America,
yeah.
But it's run by Coca-Cola here, and it's run by Suntory in Japan. So you haven't got a single, unlike Pepsi or Coke, if you were competing with them, you haven't got a single global sort of strategy, spending, marketing budget where they go, hang on, red alert, somebody's launched this thing over here that seems to be competitive. What shall we do? Should we to do our own premium product alongside them and so on. So, it's, you know, there's no one guiding mind behind the Schweppes brand. It's very, you know, there are more than three. I mean, those are just the big three that we can think of, companies that own the Schweppes brand around the world. I suspect that, A, if they'd been against one of the top brands that, that have a single owner, they'd have been up against more stiff competition. And secondly, I think even when they get outside the UK, when they encounter Dr. Pepper, Snapple in North America, or Coca-Cola in other markets, they may find that this is tricky.
Okay, well, we'll revisit this brand conversation, no doubt, because it is likely to be a structural part of the portfolio, isn't it?
Yeah. I like the new company we're buying is a consumer staple stock.
Well, on that basis, yeah, we would love to have you back and discuss that matter some more. But you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much, Terry and Julian, for your informative thoughts. On the AGM, obviously people can't just sort of rock up to the AGM, but you do put a video out, don't you?
Yes, we do. Right? Yeah, so we'll post a video of the AGM.
Onto the website, yep. And the shareholder letter. So two things to, one you can consume already and the other to look out for. But to listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever platform you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.